This is Creepy and Geeky. Welcome. I'm your host, Robert, and my guest today is Preston Fossil. Preston is an award-winning writer whose work has appeared in Fangoria, Rue Morgue, Scream, and on The Daily Grindhouse, Dread Central, and Cinedump.com. His debut novel, Our Lady of the Inferno, won the 2019 Independent Publishers Gold Medal for Horror and was named one of the 10 best books of the year by Bloody Disgusting. He currently serves as the managing editor for The Daily Grindhouse. His next novel, Beasts of 42nd Street, will be released spring of 2023 by Cemetery Dance. Welcome back to the show, Preston.
Thanks for having me. I always enjoy doing these, so it's always a delight to come back.
Yeah, I love having you on. It's always educational in some way. So speaking of Beasts of 42nd Street, you just got the cover announced yesterday, and so I thought we'd go ahead and jump into talking about some of that a little bit. What's the book about?
So the book takes place in the summer of 1977 in Times Square, and it follows a junkie theater projectionist who is jockeying for control of a possibly cursed film reel with a corrupt cop, a washed-up actor, and a pair of satanic cultists, all of whom want to possess it for their own nefarious purposes. When I pitched it, it was my comp was Taxi Driver meets Hellraiser.
That's awesome. Yeah, that sounds awesome. I believe you mentioned that this is a pseudo sort of prequel to Our Lady of the Inferno. Something in Our Lady of the Inferno mentions this incident.
Yes. So Our Lady of the Inferno and Beast of 42nd Street both center around the Colossus Theater. And in Our Lady of the Inferno, that's where my main character, Ginny, hangs out in her downtime. And very early in the book, it's mentioned that the theater came under new management a few years ago because it got gutted by a fire. And the events of Beasts of 42nd Street will lead up to who was responsible for that fire and why it came about.
Awesome. Yeah, that's very cool. Yeah, I can't wait to read it. I'm almost finished with listening to the audiobook of Our Lady of the Inferno. It's been a great ride so far. Voice work is great. Barbara Crampton, Mick Garris, Doug Bradley, some stellar people in there. But yeah, it's a fun ride so far, and I'll be finished with it soon. And I can't wait to read Beast of 42nd Street.
Thank you.
Yeah. Anything else you want to mention about the book?
I'm just really excited for it to come out into the world because I had a publisher for it 2 years ago, and then they went under. And I mean, we had great blurbs for this thing. The last publisher had been sending out arcs for it. And Mick Garris read it and loved it. Rebecca McKendry read it and loved it. Bloody Disgusting read it and loved it. The AV Club read it and loved it. And then I started trying to shop this thing to other publishers. And kind of the across the board response I got was, this is really great, and I won't touch it with a 10-foot pole. And sort of the consent, I mean, this is the thing. It's about a 250 page book. Nobody even dies in it until about the halfway point. But people just found it, and I'm quoting a rejection letter here, tonally upsetting. And that was kind of the gist of the feedback I got on this was that it wasn't that it was too violent. It wasn't that it was too graphically sexual. It wasn't, you know, any of that. It's too upsetting, and kind of proud of that. I'm not happy that it caused it to, you know, take 2 years of my life to find a new publisher for it. But the fact that so many people read it, liked it, but were so bothered by it that they didn't want to contribute to putting it out in the world is kind of a backhanded compliment. It's darkly flattering.
Oh, most definitely. Yeah, no, I'm glad it finally found a publisher that has the the balls to actually publish something like that. Yes. Especially with good word of mouth like that, you know, Mick right. Garris and Rebecca McKendry, everybody else. I mean, those are high praise from very, very good people in the industry. So,
and I'm very happy. Kevin Lucia is the new editor at Cemetery Dance, who recently took over, and he's just been wonderful to work with. And he's the one who read this and was like, we've got to put this out, and has just been super enthusiastic about it and just really wonderful. And I'm really grateful to him and Cemetery Dance for seeing the literary merits in this and wanting to put it into people's hands.
Yeah, no, most definitely. Yeah, no, it's I'm excited to check it out. Everybody else, check it out. Go check out Our Lady of the Inferno if you haven't. And go check out some of his other stuff. Landis, The Story of a Man on 42nd Street, and The Despicable Adventures of Quentin Sirgenev?
Despicable Fantasies of Quentin Sirgenev, a.k.a. the go. Book. A.k.a. the book I should have named something else.
Yeah, that one trips me up every time. So, but yeah, no, you were not definitely alone. check out every. Oh man, yeah, definitely check out his stuff. It's great stuff. So, I give it high marks for, and I don't read a lot outside of comic books these days. So, you know, definitely give those a read, and if not, definitely give that Our Lady of the Inferno audiobook a listen on Audible. Great voice work and by everybody. So it's all good. All right. Well, today we are talking a couple of more mainstream movies than we normally talk about when we have Preston on. We are going to be talking about Night of the Comet and Night of the Creeps. I put out there to Preston a while ago, just, you know, whatever movies he wanted to talk about. And Preston really wanted to talk about these movies. So I was like, yeah, I'm all in. I enjoy these movies. So, you know, it should be a fun conversation. So let's start right off with, I guess, Night of the Comet. It's interesting. I never saw these movies when they came out growing up. It wasn't until even just maybe a year, maybe two ago, that I actually saw them for the first time. And I enjoyed them. I think I probably would have enjoyed them more, and they probably would have had a much deeper impact on me if I had seen them when I was a kid. I think they are the kind of movies that I would have really enjoyed and really gotten into, and probably would have been something that would have been a constant rewatch growing up. So it's always surprising what I did watch and what I didn't watch, what hit me and what didn't. But watching these movies was a lot of fun. Like I said, I really wish I would have seen them earlier, just so I would have gotten that better impact. But Night of the Comet is like a lot of fun. It's so goofy at times, but I mean, both of these movies are very goofy. This one winks and nods, not as much as Night of the Creeps does. But this one's so much, you know, about the two girls and, you know, Preston, if you want to kind of go over the plot for everybody and kind of give us a little plot synopsis, that'd be great.
Yeah, so it's about a comet that passes through Earth's atmosphere, and anybody who is outside and directly exposed to the comet is vaporized. Anybody who is indoors behind lead lining or other material that shields people from the comets is completely protected, and people who are indirectly exposed to the light of the comet are turned into zombies. And the film follows the misadventures of two valley girls whose father was a Army Green Beret who very clearly always wanted boys instead, and so essentially raised them up as boys, and they are completely proficient in military technology and hand-to-hand combat and martial arts, but they're also very stereotypically 1980s girly girl. And so their response to the end of the world is twofold. First, they hit up an armory, load up on machine guns, and then they go shopping. And beyond that, one of the things that I like about the movie is that there's not really so much a plot as it is just these series of vignettes following these two girls on this like crazy post-apocalyptic romp through Southern California.
Oh yeah, most definitely. Yeah, it's they kind of shoehorn in a little bit of a plot there with the government people, well, sort of government people.
Yeah.
You know, who've survived the comet, but they are starting to suffer the effects of being turned into zombies. And they're trying to figure out why these girls haven't been affected. And outside of that, yeah, it's mostly just kind of like going along with the girls, and they meet a guy, this trucker, and they just kind of, which was a little odd to me, like when thinking about the ages of everybody, because I was like, the trucker's definitely an adult, and both of these girls are definitely teenage high school girls, because they both talk about being in high school and everything. So it was, I mean, the 80s, you know, but it's fun because it is very loose, and you just have these vignettes of, you know, them just going along. They go to a radio station and they do some fun stuff there. And then they go to the mall, and it's very, very goofy, weird in that way, and very loose. And it doesn't feel like unstructured in a way. They're definitely going from, you know, A to B, but it's definitely not as plot driven as, you know, a lot of other movies, most other movies. So.
Yeah. And something I really like about it is that they don't try to enforce a plot onto it. Cause I feel like in a lot of ways it is this kind of escapist fantasy thing. And it's like, well, what would you do with limitless resources, firepower, and you know, access to whatever you wanted in this kind of fantasy version of the 1980s.
Yeah. No, I found that interesting. The especially like with, you know, the concept of it. The comet is coming to Earth, or passing Earth. In the beginning, you've got a lot of people. You know, they know the comet's coming, so you got a lot of people outside partying. You got people in New York. Just I'm assuming it was New York. Get them outside on the streets, just ready for the comet. You know, very much. You know, if you remember. People remember Independence Day, and everybody's like, oh, the aliens are here, you know? And so it's very much in that same vein. And so it's very goofy. And, but then everybody that's out there just gets wiped out. They all turn into this, like, you know, orangey pink dust. It's just, and I mean, you assume it's all the planet, but you never really know outside of the zone of, you know, New York City, you don't really hear, you know, see much else. I think it's New York, or maybe it's LA.
Yeah, Southern California.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I knew I was getting that wrong, but yeah, it makes more sense to be LA because Valley Girls in Southern California. Yeah. So, but yeah, they, outside of that zone, I don't think you hear much outside of that, but I'm assuming with the government people and everything, you kind of, You again assume that it's happened everywhere because nobody's got any other information about it. But it's, you know, like we said, very loose plot. So you don't get a lot of details. You don't get a lot of, exposition about anything. It's very much these two girls and pretty much the story outside of, you know, once in a while you get little asides to the government people. It's very solidly on the girls' experiences, and it's very much centered around them. So outside of their little bubble, there's not really anything else story-wise that you get. There's no, like I said, there's no exposition about what's going on anywhere else. So it's kind of like the, you know, the typical zombie story doesn't really come into it. And even the zombies that they encounter are more of, they're intelligent zombies. They're not brainless, because it's just people who have been affected. And in a way, I guess, you know, losing their inhibitions in a way, just making them go after people, you know, nefarious reasons.
And that's the thing that I like about it is that it's weirdly it is a horror comedy, but then it's also kind of this character study of these two girls and their relationship. And there's a lot more intelligent writing and characterization between these two sisters than you would expect from a film like this. And there's this very real dynamic between them, with the little sister kind of feeling inferior to her bigger sister, and that her bigger sister is the more popular one and is more attractive to boys, and that gives her sort of this inferiority complex. And her older sister is this like very type A personality, and you see their home dynamics where their father is absent and their stepmother is abusive. And so the older sister is that way because she's kind of taken on the mother role to her little sister. And it's just very smart. And there's all these very subtle moments in their interactions that a lot of other movies would not have bothered. It would have just been, hey, here's two Valley girls, and one's a cheerleader and one's a tomboy, and they're going to shoot some zombies. And isn't that cool? And then it, does these unexpected things that make it worth a rewatch to look for those character moments.
Yeah, no, I agree. That moment with them sitting on the police car, especially just them kind of processing, before they head to the mall after they shoot the guns. That definitely is one of those things where little heart to heart between them. And I think that by foregoing a strict plot, that you do get better character moments like that, because you can sit the characters down in these little vignettes and have them interact with each other, and stripping away all the extraneous exposition, the characters, everything else, the B plots and everything else, you get more a stronger character story, especially between, like you said, between these two different types of girls and their dynamic. And that's that is what's fun about it, is I mean, and even the guy, the trucker that comes in, that becomes a somewhat love interest for the older sister, he's really not in it all that much. He's very much a low, very low side character, that gives them something to interact with, and gives them something to kind of not fight, but kind of have some push and pull with each other more than anything else. And so he serves more of a, and it's interesting too, because this is very much a movie about these two girls, that this kind of flips the kind of the gender norm type of movie that you kind of see with this kind of stuff, where a girl comes in and it's two guys and they're fighting over the girl and everything. And it happens the same way, but the guy is definitely put in that more subservient role. And he's definitely much more of a foil to them, rather than being, rather than coming in and being, oh, I'm going to take all this on and I'll save you girls and everything. It's like, more because they have the training and the knowledge of guns and everything, they're more of the types that are pushing the plot forward and saving him and everything. So it's a, especially for the 80s, it's a fun little switch on the dynamic that you normally get.
I would even be curious, because you're saying all this now, and I'm thinking to myself, this is sort of a like 1980s like new wave take on The Quiet Earth, but with zombies, or The World, the Flesh, and the Devil. And I was about to say, I wonder if he was in the original script and the studio like wanted like a dude in there because they were afraid of a movie not being able to be fronted by two women. But now that you're saying all this, now it does make sense.
No, I mean, that could be the studio pushed the guy into that, but I mean, it could also just be that the writers were just like, all right, let's throw in this, this little dynamic between them. It gives them something to kind of fight about between themselves over who's going to get the guy or whatever. And it's just, yeah, it's just it just makes it definitely an interesting take on something that normally you would get the opposite of.
Because I do know that there are some changes in the film from the original script, because in the original script, the Sam character, Kelly Maroney's character, the younger sister, was supposed to die at the end. And when you think she's dead in the original script, she was actually dead.
Oh, wow.
And the character was originally written as like this almost like scrappy do, like super obnoxious sidekick character to the older sister. And the older sister was more of a singular focus for the film. And then when Kelly Maroney showed up and started playing this character, she just kind of had a different take on it. And it ended up turning out much more sympathetic. And that's where some of this dynamic started to develop. And Tom Eberhardt said, well, you know, I can't kill this character anymore. She's much more lovable and much more endearing. And the audience is really going to like her. And this is much more a sort of deuteragonist story instead of just having this one protagonist. And so that really changed the course of the film and how that final act unraveled.
That's good. I like that. Cause when she dies in the movie, or, you know, quote unquote dies in the movie, when they, you're just kind of left, cause it's a weird sequence too. Cause you're not sure that, like, I don't know. It wasn't super clear to me when I watched it, that they are killing her, until after the fact. And they're like, okay, well, you know, she's dead now. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, that was kind of weird. And, so yeah, it's kind of disappointing because she has endeared herself, because both of them, you know, they both have these Valley Girl attitudes here and there, but they're both sympathetic. They both have their little quirks and, you know, things that make them interesting. And, you know, she could have definitely, Kelly Maroney could have definitely played it as very bratty and annoying, very much like you said, a scrappy dude like character. And sure, at that point we would all been like, oh, thank God she's dead, let's move on, let's get on with the story. But the way she played it for sure made you very sympathetic to her, and when she dies you're just like, oh, well, what? And so when she comes back, it's, you know, you're excited that, you know, she's back and they all get to, you know, ride off into the sunset together, as it were.
If you want a glimpse into how the character was originally written, if you watch Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Kelly Maroney plays a cheerleader in that movie. And she has this one scene where she like goes off on the audience during a pep rally. And Tom Eberhardt based the character on that character from Fast Times at Ridgemont High. And then when they were casting the movie, he told the casting director, find me somebody like that girl who played the cheerleader in Fast Times at Ridgemont High. And the casting director knew Kelly Maroney's agent and said, I can just get you the girl from Fast Times at Ridgemont High. And so if you you go back and watch Fast Times, that's how he had originally written the character, and much more how they had originally envisioned Sam coming off, except as a larger role in Night of the Comet.
Right. That's interesting. It's been a long time since I've seen Fast Times. But that's interesting that then she comes in, you know, ostensibly to play that character again, and then she plays it much, you know, deeper and less, you know, annoying. And so that's interesting that then he has to change it to fit that more nuanced performance rather than, you know, the straight up annoying cheerleader. So that's awesome. I love that. Very cool. Let's see. And of course, this is, I think this was 86?
86,
So this was the same year that Catherine Mary Stewart played in Last Starfighter as well. So I found that interesting that she, Last Starfighter, it's a much, much smaller role. She's just the girlfriend of the character. So it's, you know, but Last Starfighter definitely has the bigger, recognition over time.
Yeah.
And so seeing her in this, you know, especially, you know, knowing her from Last Starfighter, and I grew up with that one, of course, that was the movie I remember, and I have it on Blu-ray and everything. Going back and then seeing her in Night of the Comet, I was like, oh, hey, that's interesting. Same girl. I'd never heard of this movie. And so it was interesting to see. And like I said, it's weird to see what movies I saw as a kid and what movies I didn't see, and which ones I loved more. And so it's fun to see that I missed this one somehow, and it never caught me.
So, you know, a lot of people did. So Night of the Comet was not a super big success at the box office. And then it really found a second life as like a late night cable staple. And for a particular generation of teenage girls, this was like this big destination slumber party movie. I actually know Kelly Maroney. I met her several years ago when I did a career retrospective with her, and we've stayed in touch since. And she's told
Awesome.
me, no, going into the 90s and early 2000s, the fan letters I got were all from women who had been teenage girls in the 80s and who had these memories of, getting together with their girlfriends and watching Night of the Comet. But because it was like this late night cable staple, it never really got that sort of mainstream fan cachet until we moved into the later 90s and early 2000s, and it got more of a dedicated home video and DVD release. And so you and I are not alone. I mean, I was obsessively consuming every movie like this I could get my hands
Yeah.
on between, the ages of 17 and, well, now. And I mean, I didn't see this thing until it would have been 2013 as a Netflix disc, back when they still really leaned on the physical media arm of the company.
Right.
Because I have very vivid memories of seeing this movie for the first time.
Yeah, I mean that makes a lot of sense, especially if like it maybe didn't have as much a, like as big of a VHS life as rental life as it did more of the cable life. And I had cable off and on as a kid, but it wasn't something that I was able to watch like religiously a lot, like a lot of kids in the 80s. My parents didn't restrict my viewing. I just we only had cable out in the living room, so it wasn't like I got to watch very much out there unless they were out there too. And so yeah, I mean that makes a lot of sense. And I got it, I've been, the last few years I've been really kind of, buying and checking out new like older horror stuff that I missed. And this just happened to be one of the ones that I'd seen pop up several times, which was good. I mean, it's obviously gotten more recognition over the years now, and especially since I started, paying more attention to it, that, this is one of those movies that people talk about and is like, okay, yeah, this is a good fun 80s flick to watch, and it has a great stream Scream Factory release. So it's and that's where I ended up grabbing it at, was Scream Factory eventually. So it's definitely has a better life now than it did back in the 80s, for sure.
Yeah, it's interesting to read about this. Night of the Comet was not alone in this. A lot of studio pictures back in the 80s that had female leads, especially with like multiple female leads, kind of got buried by the studios. And then cable really became the champion of these movies, and where viewers, the intended viewing audience, could find them. There's this great comedy called Modern Girls. Have you heard of this one? I don't want to make assumptions.
I don't think so.
So it's Virginia Madsen is the main actress, and Daphne Zuniga from Spaceballs, and then I always forget the third actress's name. And it's just very similar to Night of the Comet in its structure, except it's not a genre film, it's just a straight up comedy. And it is just one night and the adventures that these three roommates have on this odyssey through the LA club scene. And it's just really fun and really lighthearted and zany. It's kind of a female After Hours, really. But with three people instead of one, and somewhat lighter tone in Los Angeles. It's a great movie. It's one of my favorite comedies. And this thing really lived as a like late night cable artifact on HBO in the 80s, because it just sort of got buried at the theaters by the studio. And it's interesting to find out that late night cable was kind of like destination viewing for a generation of teens and young 20-something women back in the 80s, because these movies that were ostensibly geared towards them at the theaters like didn't really get the advertising or the visibility they needed to become the successes that they were meant to be.
Right. Yeah, no, it's yeah, definitely, because I mean we had a lot less theaters, a lot less screens back in the day, especially in the 80s. I mean we had more in the 80s than we did, previous to that because of the rise of the multiplex at the malls and stuff. But even then, yeah, it's just as like it is today, blockbusters sell, and all the small movies, they get put into the small theaters, run for a week, and then because they don't do well, bye bye. But I think that, whereas we had the cable, avenue for a lot of that back then. We now have the streaming, and I think that a lot of movies and people complain about movies just getting dumped on streaming. And don't get me wrong, because the streamers, especially somebody like Netflix, they don't do a shit ton of advertising for a lot of stuff that they put, and they put out way so much content that there's a lot of stuff that does get buried and gets, lost in the shuffle. But I also think that, it's great that we have streaming, all these different streaming platforms to give avenues to all these movies that by and large wouldn't even have a chance in the theaters. There's a lot of people who complain about, this, that, and the other movies not getting a theatrical release. And it's like, but a lot of these movies wouldn't survive in the theaters now. People just don't care to go to the theaters to go watch anything but the big blockbusters. And that's been that way since the 80s at minimum. And I mean, it's even before then, because that's the reason why we have what the term B pictures is, because there was the A, the blockbuster, and the B picture afterward, which was, some low rent, lower tier, not necessarily lower rent, but a lower tier movie that, people weren't really going to watch. And so, I think that's what's great about streaming nowadays, is that there is so much out there. And if you can weed through it, you can find that stuff. And I see that in a lot of ways. There's a lot more content driven towards women, towards children, towards teens, a lot more of that, than, I think that, sure, a lot of things are going to get lost in the shuffle, but if people can find it, there's a lot of good out there. And I think that that's, what cable was doing back in the day too. So that's what's nice about it now.
I'm conflicted about that, because, streaming does provide all these opportunities, but it seems now that, you log on and it's like 20 new movies a day. And, especially with someplace like Netflix, there's almost zero curation. And you've seen this movie, The Legend of 1900, which I think it's Tim Roth. It's not really a good movie. It's about this pianist. He's got almost agoraphobia. He's lived his entire life on board this ship that's being decommissioned, and he's going to be forced to come off this ship for the first time in his life. And near the end of the movie, he's explaining why he doesn't want to leave the ship in terms of music. And I'm not quoting this exactly, but he says, "With a limited number of piano keys, I can make infinite music. With an infinite number of piano keys, I don't know which keys to strike, so I can make no music." And I almost feel like we've reached that point with streaming. And it's great that everybody's getting these movies made. It's great that we're in this, golden age of, democratized filmmaking. But then how do you decide what to watch? And, how do you decide where to go and what to watch at that destination versus this destination? And there was a point in time that my Netflix queue, my personal list had probably 200-300 things on it. And I would spend more time trying to decide what to watch than actually watching something. And there's nights that I would fall asleep scrolling through the queue and then doze off before I actually landed on what I wanted to see. And part of me misses that age of cable, where there was a somewhat more limited number of choices. I had, 200 channels, but on each of those channels, there was one movie showing at any given time. Right. And I discovered so many great things that way. And I feel like I almost can't discover things counterintuitively now with even more out there.
Yeah, no, I can get that. I understand that to a degree. I think that, for me, cable is very much like, when I had cable, it was very much like the same way I feel about streaming nowadays. Yes, streaming nowadays has so many choices. There's so many different streamers, so many choices on each one. And like you said, most of them don't have very good curation. And so you if you're looking for something specific, it's kind of hard to find. Literally, I have so many different streaming platforms I subscribe to: Netflix, Hulu, Apple, Shudder, you name it, I probably have it. All the major ones anyway. But I do the same thing. I have so many movies on each one that I go, okay, what am I going to watch today? And then I'm like completely freeze in my head. But I had the same problem with cable back in the day too, because 200 channels, there was nothing ever to watch. Or I would end up landing on the same thing I've watched a billion freaking times. And so, you know, that's where I like, that's the problem I've always had with it, is it's very much the same situation. Whereas now, you know, at least now I try to be like, okay, I've already watched this thing once. I don't need to watch this again. Now, usually when I'm going to bed, I watch something that I've seen a billion times because it's easy to fall asleep to. My brain will shut up. But it's, you know, but outside of that, you know, I try to choose things, and it's very difficult. I'm trying to do the 100 horror movies in 92 days challenge thing. And as last year, I'm failing that immensely because I keep getting distracted by one thing or another, or I have to watch stuff to talk about the podcast. And most of the stuff that I'm watching for the podcast has actually been stuff I've watched before. So, you know, it's been difficult to say the least, but there's plenty out there for me to watch. I just, too many choices. but like we said, you know, it's great that so many people are getting a chance to make all these different TV shows and movies and stuff that they probably wouldn't have had a chance otherwise. And even though it's hard to find, I think that, and I think that's what's great about social media at times too, if you can curate your social media correctly, you can get good recommendations on stuff. You can get a lot of people who recommend really fantastic movies here and there. I've been watching quite a few of the more recent Shudder releases because of that, because people have been talking about stuff like Glorious by Rebecca McKendry, who you mentioned earlier, who invited them was really fun. There's been a few others that are completely blanking on right now, but there's been some really good stuff on Shudder lately. And of course, you know, Shudder is always the great place to go for horror stuff, but it's, you know, it's, I don't even know where I was going with this. So anyway, but Night of the Comet. I feel like it's definitely a movie that for sure would have gotten lost in the shuffle of the 80s. Female leads, a very thin plotted story. And I can see where that would have been more of a video staple. Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. More of a at home experience where you can just kind of luxuriate in it rather than, because we, like we said, when you go to the movies, you're looking for, you know, you're looking for some action, and there's not a lot of action in this movie. There's, you know, little bits here and there, but it's not, it's more about these girls just like discovering what is going on and, you know, kind of coming to terms with each other over the course of, what is it? It's like a day. Like,
yeah, it's like a couple of days,
maybe a day or two. Yeah. And so, you know, by the end of it, you know, it's, you know, they, thankfully the rain comes, and this movie's got great color because what they're doing with, while the, right after the comet comes, and there's, you know, and the dust has settled, it's kind of still settling in the air. And so they've colored the sky like kind of pink and purple and orange and stuff, and kind of just given it this unnatural hue. But then finally the rain comes and it kind of washes it all the way, washes all the dust away, and just kind of goes, okay, well, everybody who's survived up till this point and hasn't been infected is actually okay now, and kind of washed it away. And, you know, hopefully you people can just kind of move on from this point, which I, you know, again, very cheesy, very simple, you know, explanation for things, but, you know, it works. It works really well.
It's just such a fun movie.
It is. Yeah. It's just fun. I mean, and that's ultimately where you come to it. Like it's not going to be one of those movies that is going to be, you know, considered one of the best ever, but it's a good, like, fun movie, just going through a couple of days in these girls' lives after everybody else in the planet is pretty much wiped out, and, you know, and figuring out what they're going to do next. And, you know, and you're kind of still left with, you know, what are they going to do next? They're kind of left, you know, sort of in a, you know, sort of in an interesting position at the end, but you know, it's more still, you're left hanging. And that's great, because that's what the whole movie is you just left with a series of questions that you're just like, okay, well, that's fine, you know, but it's just a fun movie and you can enjoy it just for what it is. And that's what I like about it. Anything else specifically you want to say about Night of the Comet?
I've just got a big soft spot for this movie because it was something that I needed at a particular time in my life. Prior to writing Our Lady of the Inferno, I had been working on this thing that I now just call the theater story. And it was very tonally similar. It was set in the late 70s, early 80s, New York City, and it was about the employees of a Times Square movie theater. And I started working on this thing. It would have been late 2006, maybe early 2007. And I was still working on it in like 2013 when I saw Night of the Comet. And it had gotten up to like 250,000 pages. And I had like 25 main characters. And there was like no plot. And this thing was like turning into like the Tolstoy of grindhouse theater stories. And I just kept working at it because I'd been working at it. And it was, you know, becoming the sunk cost fallacy. And I couldn't put my finger on what wasn't working. And I watched Night of the Comet, and like I hadn't chosen this for any really particular reason. The summary sounded cool. I put it on my Netflix queue. And the disc comes in the mail, and I finish this thing, and I'm like, this is what you should be writing. The thing you're working on isn't fun. It's not engaging. The characters aren't as likable as these two girls. And the joie de vivre of this movie is what you don't have in your book. And the night that I watched Night of the Comet is the night that I decided to scrap the theater story. And I started laying the groundwork for Our Lady of the Inferno. And if I had not seen Night of the Comet when I did, I don't know that I would have written that book. And I don't know that I'd be here talking about that book and my fourth book coming out now. And so it's this movie that very unexpectedly sort of changed the trajectory of my life.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thank you, Night of the Comet. But yeah, no, it's a, yeah, no, it's just a fun movie. That's, I love the, you know, that helps you figure that out. Yeah. I've had a story idea stuck in my head for 20 plus years that I haven't been able to fully get out yet. And, one of these days, maybe I'll have the patience to actually sit down and write it out. But, yeah, so I can't even imagine just a story just as big as what you were doing, let alone being able to, you know, condense it. So, but that's cool that, that helped you figure that out. So, all right. So Night of the Creeps. So definitely a much different movie. In a way, we're still dealing with, you know, something from outer space coming and affecting, some people. But this one's much more, this one's definitely got a plot to it. This one's got, this one's a lot more goofy. Whereas, you know, you had the two Valley girls who had, you know, they weren't really goofy. So they're like, Night of the Comet was played pretty straight up. You know, there were some, you know, fun moments here and there, and it's definitely a comedy. But Night of the Creeps is definitely played as it's an homage to, you know, the B pictures of the 50s and 60s, the alien monster movies and stuff. And so it involves a which is funny because I forgot about this, that in the very beginning, there's this spaceship coming close to Earth. And there's these little short, weird looking aliens on it. And one's trying to escape from the others. And he's got some kind of cylinder in his hand. And he's trying to get away with it and manages to eject it from the ship before the others get to him. Then the thing lands on Earth. And then we get this sequence of black and white. It's the, 1959, I believe. And so it's all in black and white. And we get these people hanging out at the point. And I believe, again, we're in L.A. So there's so many things going on in this one. There's an escaped mental patient And the cops are looking for him. And then there's the couple at the point who see the thing coming from space, and they go to investigate it. One of the girl that's part of the couple, she is the ex-girlfriend of the cop who is trying to hunt down the escaped mental patient. And so it's very convoluted. And the guy that she's with in the car, they stop, find the cylinder. He gets out, goes to look for it. Meanwhile, she's in the car still. And we kind of fade to black. Move forward, because I believe the guy, her date, gets attacked, and we just kind of move forward. They kind of skip, and there's we assume the mental patient is about to kill her because we see somebody coming up behind her while she's hollering for her boyfriend. I'm doing a very bad job at plot synopsis here.
There's a lot going on, like you said.
Prologue.
More going on in the prologue of Night of the Creeps than all of Night of the Comets.
Right. Oh, man. And so then it jumps forward to the 1980s. I believe this one also came out in 1986. It's
86. Yep.
86. Okay. So an 86 double feature. So it's so we jump to 86, and then we are with these two college nerd kind of guys. They're kind of nerdy. Jason Lively is the main guy now, and he's some people recognize him as the son in European Vacation, National Lampoon's European Vacation.
Oh.
He plays Rusty in that.
I did not realize that.
Yeah, I used to see, and this is again, Night of the Creeps is a movie I didn't watch a lot. But for some reason, European Vacation was one I did watch a lot in the 80s. And so it was just funny that I was like, oh, yeah, hey. So, so he's and weird fact, he's the stepbrother to Blake Lively.
Really?
Yep. Yep. Huh. Yeah, I think his dad married her mom later or something. So they're related in that way. So they these two guys are out. They go to a, I guess, wait, is it a frat party or is it just I guess it's a frat party of some sort. They see this girl that Jason Lively's character has fallen in love with, even though he's never talked to her or anything. He just falls in love with her at sight, like you do. And so the story moves on from there, these boys want to get into a fraternity because the Jason Lively's character thinks that that's the way he's going to get this girl, is by being in a fraternity. The head of the fraternity says, okay, well, we'll consider you guys for the fraternity if you go do this prank. And they're supposed to go get this dead body out of this facility and throw it onto some sorority's front yard. They go into the facility, things are all funky there, and the body twitches, and the body's in stasis, by the way, in cryostasis, and goes to the twitches, and they book it out of there running scared. But later on, we find out that the head has been kind of blown open and something has come out of it. What you find out is they're space slugs of some sort that take over human bodies. Well, the cop that investigates this is a detective now, and it's the cop from earlier, played by, genre legend Tom Atkins, which is always awesome. And he has the, one of the most quotable lines of the 80s, "Thrill me." So I don't want to get too far into, going over the plot, but the space slugs, they get into you, they take over your body, turn you into zombies. They basically kill you. So we're kind of getting another space zombie movie here. So interesting to 1986 Night of the something movies about space zombies. and so it's a, it's This one's way more goofy. Played actually way played for laughs. But there is a lot of seriousness to it as well. I found that interesting. There's definitely some pathos to it that you're not expecting from such a goofy premise. The Tom Atkins is a drunk cop haunted by the death of his girlfriend, his ex-girlfriend, I don't know. Go ahead.
There's a lot of darker undercurrents to this one. Yeah. The roommates of Lively's character has a mm-hmm. cerebral palsy and is kind of persona non grata on campus because of this, and takes a lot of crap for the fact that he, gets around on a cane. And then there's a very dire moment involving that character's ultimate mm-hmm. fate in the movie that has always stuck with me, and I can still hear that voice every time I think of the movie on the recording. I don't want to spoil this for anybody who hasn't seen the movie yet, but it's a very unexpected emotional gut punch in a movie about outer space brain slugs.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, you watch that scene and you're just like, wow, like that's like it's an emotional like throw in the middle of the movie, and the movie doesn't, we're on both ends of it, like before and after that point, you're just kind of like, it doesn't really play that way, but that little bit is so like, it's from a totally different fucking movie. Mm-hmm. But it weirdly fits with this movie, and it works really well in this. This one was God, before I say it, I believe this movie was Fred Decker's first movie. He went on to do Monster Squad. It's Fred Decker hasn't done a lot of movies though. He did Night of the Creeps. He's written a few, but he hasn't really directed that many. Night of the Creeps, Monster Squad, and couple more.
He's only directed six films, and out of those, two are shorts and one's an episode of a TV series. He's only directed Night of the Creeps, Monster Squad, and RoboCop 3.
Oh right, RoboCop 3. Yeah. Now Fred Decker's largely not largely known because he's largely known from Monster Squad, but he's also writing partners with Shane Black, who has had a much bigger career in terms of writing and directing. Shane Black is the writer of the first Lethal Weapon, Last Boy Scout, the Last Action Hero, and has written and directed two of my favorites, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang and The Nice Guys, but maybe more well known for having written and directed Iron Man 3 and the more recent The Predator movie. And I think Fred Decker was actually involved in the Predator writing as well.
He was, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So he's had his ups and downs in terms of, genre. But I think Night of the Creeps stands very well, along with Monster Squad as a kind of a seminal 80s kind of goofy picture. Again, Night of the Creeps wasn't something I saw. But to be fair, I didn't see Monster Squad until recently either. I never saw it as a kid either. So it's for some reason, again, some of these movies, I think is the later 80s kind of stuff too, 86, because how old would I? I should have been the right age. 86, I was 12. So, it just kind of depends on, I was always kind of more of an action comedy guy, still kind of am. So it's funny just to go back and watch these movies and go, I really should have enjoyed this as a kid. I really should have. It should have been one of those movies that would have been a staple for me as well. So, but again, without seeing cable or without having going and renting it, then it's likely I would have never seen it. But it's just a fun movie. Again, it's definitely playing. It's Decker obviously has a, with this and Monster Squad, he was obviously going for homages towards things he enjoyed as a kid. and which is not a bad thing. And I think he succeeds very well with this and Monster Squad.
It's cool, and this is one of the reasons that I wanted to pair it with Night of the Comet, is you really, people complain today, oh, everybody wants to do 80s nostalgia, and everybody just wants, you know, throwback to 80s stuff, but it's one of these instances of the more things change, the more they stay the same, because you go back to the 80s, everybody in the 80s wanted 50s throwback stuff, and with Night of the Comet, Night of the Creeps, even John Carpenter's Thing, you have this cycle of sci-fi horror films that are all very directly in dialogue with 1950s sci-fi B pictures, and even down to the Night of the Blank naming conventions. You've got this virulent strain of 50s nostalgia in the media of the 80s, and it's fun to look at that from the present day perspective of us glorifying 80s media the way people in the 80s glorified 50s media.
I definitely see it. There's so many people who complain about it, that there's so many people who are, you know, doing this 80s throwback stuff, you know, Stranger Things and everything else kind of even brought that even heavier in more recent years. You know, I don't have anything against that. I enjoy, you know, when it's done well, you know, Stranger Things is done well. There's a movie called Summer of 84 that's really good. There's lots of little things here and there. Night of the Comet, Night of the Creeps. We got The Stuff, Killer Clowns. All those were definitely major throwbacks to that 50s and 60s era of, alien invasion, paranoia, just all of that. And The Blob, so many of those things were just throwbacks to that generation. I mean, and it started even earlier than that, because in regular media, not genre media, but we had Happy Days and all that kickstarted that in a lot of way. And it's always like that. Every generation, you grow up and you want to go back to what you knew as a kid and what you liked as a kid, and you're going to like bring that forward and go, okay, this is what I like. I'm going to do my own take on this, and I'm going to update it and have more fun with it. And I do enjoy that, like going back and looking at these movies and going, okay, I see what they're doing, and they're having a good time with that, and they're not taking themselves seriously, which is great. Mm-hmm. They neither one of these movies is going, I'm going to update. They're not like, that's where I think movies or TV shows fail, is when they take themselves a little too seriously with their time period or their genre or whatever, and they're trying to update something and be like, okay, this is what the 80s was really like, and it's like, nah, stop. I want something that's goofy and fun, because the 80s were fucking boring. I lived during it. I saw a picture the other day, and it was so funny because it was so true. It was like, oh, you lived in the 80s, and it was like a bedroom that had like day glow stuff and all the neon and all the wild stuff that you associate with the 80s. But it's like, no, I grew up in the 80s, and it was this drab brown and orange like house and everything. And it was like, yes, that's exactly what the 80s was like. It was not this day glow nightmare that you guys all think it was. Yes, there were those bits and pieces. That was largely like what you see in movies. Most of us who lived in the heartland or, wherever we lived at that wasn't LA, and it was LA specific, And so if you didn't live in those areas, everything else was just shit. And not bad shit. I mean, I grew up in the 80s, but I grew up in the 80s of Satanic Panic and, having to worry about like, people stealing you off the streets, you know, predator vans and everything. And so, the 80s are a much darker time than people like to say it is. But it was okay. But it just was not the place that some people make it out to be. And that's why I'm saying Summer of 84 gets it really well done. If anybody hasn't seen Summer of 84, check that movie out, because it is really good and really kind of hones down on what the 80s were like.
Did y'all have the orange vinyl recliner too?
Ours wasn't vinyl, but it was orange. Yeah.
Ours was vinyl, had an orange one and a mauve one.
Oh man, yeah, no, everything was a gross, and it wasn't even a like even it wasn't even, well, some were bright orange, but it was that burnt orange. It was that burnt orange, like you had the TV that was in the like the wood cabinet, like and a big giant wood cabinet, and it's like, what is all in there? There's nothing there.
Close the doors on it with the little magnets up at top. My parents still have theirs. My dad has an engineering background, so he gutted the TV out of it and converted it into a linen cabinet for my mom. I go
Nice.
over to their house. They've still got the Zenith, no, Mitsubishi like giant projection screen cabinet.
Oh, that's hilarious. Yeah, and like, oh man, projector TVs back in the day. Oh, those things were ginormous. Like, and it was just ridiculous. Oh man.
Remember running your finger across it and make a little zippy sound?
Oh, the 80s were crazy, man. Yeah. So when we look back on the 80s, when we look back, when I look back on the 80s, I don't look on it favorably. I hated the 80s. I hated growing up then. Kids had it much better later on. Once we start getting into the 90s and later, like it's but that's what I do like about watching stuff like Stranger Things and stuff, is just going back and watching it. And Stranger Things gets it pretty right as well too. You know, the clothing choices as well are fairly good. You know, people trying to look fashionable but not at all. Bad haircuts galore, and yeah,
I had that bowl
too.
cut.
Oh no, I never had the bowl cut. I had I ended up getting I had my hair buzz cut for a while,
Nice.
and then later on I definitely had the mullet going on. I even I'll even admit this, in ninth grade I had a rat tail, so it was not a good fashion choice. But yeah, no, it's but these movies are great because they do, they, you know, 86, you know, we're coming, the funny thing is, the things that you remember, the things that they kind of highlight about the 80s, is stuff that came in the very late 80s. A lot of this neon colors, a lot of the sensibilities that most people associate with the 80s are very much in the latter half. And you can see it in the movies. I mean, there's a lot of the stuff that, you know, the beginning, you'll notice this in a lot of stuff too, is that in the beginning of most new decades, it's very much the trail end of the previous decade. Because that's what you see in early 90s movies and television shows as well, is they look very much like 80s, the 80s shows of that area as well. And it's so the beginning 80s, the, you know, pre, I would say, you know, pre 84, is very much a holdover of the 70s. And that's why we did have, you know, the burnt orange, and wood and everything, because it was a holdover. In a way, it was a progression from the vomit green and yellow that we had in the 70s. You know, it's you know, they kind of went into the more earth tones, and instead of the the wacky neon that we went into later on. But yeah. So Night of the Comet and Night of the Creeps, you kind of get, because they're in 86, they kind of exist in this transitory period of the 80s, where they are, you're starting to see the fashion change a little bit. But it's still a holdover from that 70s. You're still getting a lot of the feathered hair, and a lot of that hasn't really changed at that point. But it does seem like it's getting a little bit different. So, and these two movies, especially, like as opposed to some of the other 80s movies, they very firmly feel like 80s movies. There's some movies that kind of transcend the time period, and as much as you know that they're a part of the 80s, because of hairstyles and stuff like that, they can still transcend a certain time period and you can enjoy them for at any point. But these definitely feel like they're firmly entrenched in the 80s.
They're very much the product of that time period.
And I think that that also has a lot to do with, because they are aping the 50s feeling and stuff, that they are, you know, making sure, okay, this is definitely the 80s. This is not the 50s. We're doing something that is kind of like the 50s, but we're updating it. And because of that updating, they're firmly placing it in the 80s rather than trying to transcend that time period.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's a lot, you know, you get that in Killer Clowns from Outer Space and, you know, the stuff and a lot of these movies that are like that too, that because they are trying to do that, that it feels less timeless than other movies. But that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Oh, no.
If you want an enjoyable 80s romp, you couldn't go wrong with either one of these. Any other things you want to say about Night of the Creeps specifically?
Just really, it's the weirdest thing. This is the movie that I was familiar with first, because for some reason, local TV in St. Louis was forever playing this in the early 90s. And my dad hates horror movies. My dad is very much action comedy and just does not do horror movies. My mom is the horror lover in the family. She's the one that I could sit down and watch something like Texas Chainsaw Massacre with. But for some reason, these kind of horror comedies of the 80s, my dad really loved, and he's the one who showed them to me. My dad's the one who showed me Monster Squad. My dad's the one who showed me Beetlejuice and Ghostbusters and showed me Night of the Creeps on local access TV in St. Louis. And so I just have like this weird memory associated with that this is one of these movies that my decidedly horror-hating dad introduced me to, and in the process helped to engender my own love of horror.
That's cool. I like that. Yeah, I don't know. Like, that's a funny thing too. And, you know, and it's a product of my own bad memory, but I don't really remember really sitting down with either one of my parents and really, like, you know, having those kind of memories like that. I hear people all the time who, you know, their parents introduced them stuff. And my parents did. Like, my parents, you know, we sat and watched movies together. And, you know, I because by and large, that's how I had to watch movies, is when they were out there in the living room. So it was like, okay, well, let's figure out what we're going to watch. So I just kind of watched what they watched. And so So I don't really remember having that, like, oh, my parent introduced me to this, that, and the other thing. And so, you know, I definitely tried to change that with my own kids, is like, I try to show them the things that I loved. And here and there, they like some stuff. You know, my son's become a much bigger Star Wars fan than me, but I've tried to let my kids figure out their own stuff in a lot of ways too. Is just like, okay, well, I'll try to show you stuff. But and it's funnier now, because my daughter's more open to it now as an adult than she was as a kid, and is more like, okay, so, you know, what should I watch? And so that's, you know, really fun, and, you know, the impetus for starting the podcast in the first place. So, you know, it all comes around in that kind of fun way. So that's cool that you know your horror hating dad showed you something that, probably because it was more comedy. In a lot of ways that he probably was a lot more open to it than he probably would have been otherwise.
Yeah.
So, because there's not really, I mean, neither one of these movies is really scary. This one's probably got more horror to it than Night of the Comet does. Night of the Comet really is it's got a couple of scary moments, but it's generally speaking very tame. And this one's got more of that, you know, jump kind of scared aspect to it. But, you know, they're still both very fun. I can see, you know, both of them being fun family films, you know, for kind of older kids, not super young kids, but yeah, depending on your children, your mileage may vary. but you know, I'm the one again who let his daughter watch Seed of Chucky when she was three, and she loved it. So so I'm not one to talk very much. So yeah, they're both fun movies. If listeners haven't checked either one of these out, definitely go check them out. Not sure where they're playing. I need to start writing this stuff down when I talk about these movies. Say, hey, they're located on these channels. But yeah, definitely check them out. Scream Factory has a great versions of both of these movies, Night of the Comet and Night of the Creeps, they produced both of them. And Night of the Creeps, they've got both the theatrical and the director's cut versions. So definitely check those out. All right. Any last thoughts about either one of these that you have?
Great double feature, destination definitely. Viewing if you're looking for a fun Friday night.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you for suggesting them. As soon as you did, I was like, yep, that's a perfect double feature. We're going to do that. All right. Why don't you let people know where they can find you? And anything else you want to let them know about?
You can find me on Twitter at Preston Fossil, PrestonFassel. You can find pre-order Beasts of 42nd Street through CemeteryDance.com and find the rest of my books on either Amazon or Barnes & Noble.
Awesome. Well, thank you again, Preston. It's always great having you on. Always have a great time. These were definitely a little more mainstream than our usual fare. We'll be getting back to some of the more obscure titles here soon. We've already talked about a couple of different things. Wild shit coming. So be prepared for that when next we have you on.
Looking forward to it already.
All right. Thanks. Thanks again to Preston for coming on the show. Next episode, Iona Smith joins me to talk about Cabin in the Woods and Tucker and Dale versus Evil. Thanks for listening. If you liked what you heard, make sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast app or at creepyandgeeky.com. You can follow the podcast on social media at Creepy and Geeky on both Twitter and Instagram. If you'd like to follow me, I'm GeekThulu on Twitter and Geek.Thulu on Instagram. You can support the podcast by ordering teas and more from our TeePublic page. All of the links are in the show notes. Finally, don't forget, stay creepy.